The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and we are very pleased to be the kickoff event for this year's 215 Festival. If you're not familiar with the festival and all of their fun literary happenings, please go to 215festival.org for details. The fest runs through Sunday all over town at even cooler venues than this one, if you can believe that. In fact, tonight you can follow us downtown to Underground Arts, where Nicholson Baker is going to read from his hilarious and raunchy novel, House of Holes, to the dulcet tones of T.J. Kong and the Can Jam Band. We'll see you there at 9:30. Before we head underground, let's welcome our guest this evening. You know the aforementioned Nicholson Baker as the best-selling author in various genres of such sparkling gems as Room Temperature, The Mezzanine, Vox, You and I, Checkpoint, The Anthologist, where he wrote one of my favorite characters in fiction, the inimitable Shlemiel Paul Chowder, a lefty poet, anthologist, dabbler, philosopher, and lover of the elusive Roz, who he continues to pursue in the new novel, The Traveling Sprinkler. Baker will be joined this evening by the entirely too young and accomplished novelist Dara Horn, named by Granta Magazine as one of America's best young novelists. Both her first novel, In the Image, and her second, The World to Come, won the National Jewish Book Award, among other prizes. And her third novel, All Other Nights, was one of Booklist's 25 best books of the decade. She joins us tonight to present her latest creation, which has a title that will be familiar to those of you who have heard of the rationalist physician, philosopher, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, a.k.a. Rambam, a.k.a. the author of Nora Nebuchim, a.k.a. the guide of the perplexed. More on that preposition later, perhaps. Please welcome our first reader, Dara Horn.
I want to thank everyone for coming, and also thank Andy and everyone at the Free Public Library, or Free Library Philadelphia, for inviting me here tonight, and to be able to share the stage with Nicholson Baker, of course, is an immense privilege. So I want to say thank you for that. I also want to thank all of you because while you heard a little bit about my life, you didn't hear the most salient aspect of it, which is that I'm the mother of an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So it's very rare that anyone in my house ever listens to me. So I want to say thank you to all of you in advance for listening, or at least pretending to listen to what I have to say, which is more than I can say for most of the people who I live with. Since I was a child, I've had a fantasy of turning life into an archive, and perhaps this is a fantasy shared by many writers and many other people, of writing everything down and recording every moment I experience so that nothing could ever be lost. Now, of course, social media has made my dream come true and turned it into a nightmare where every idiotic thing you ever do is recorded forever. I think we usually think of this as a kind of hyper-modern problem, this information overload, but another part of my career that you didn't know is that I also am a professional nerd, by which I mean that I moonlight as a professor of Hebrew and Yiddish literature. And because of this, my professional nerdiness, I also know that this information overload or this data dumping problem has actually happened before. In 1897, a Cambridge professor named Solomon Schechter discovered a trove of medieval documents hidden in a room in a synagogue in Cairo. Because of a religious law forbidding the destruction of any text that has God's name in it, this community, like many Jewish communities around the world to this day, had a storage space called a geniza, geniza being the Hebrew word meaning hiding place, had a storage space called a geniza where they would put texts that were damaged and couldn't be used anymore, but still they couldn't throw them away. things that were water damaged or burned or something like this, or just falling apart after many years of use. Unlike many, unlike most Jewish communities around the world, this community also had the custom of saving not only texts that had God's name written in them, but saving anything that had Hebrew letters, including like grocery lists, right? I mean, really anything that had Hebrew letters. And they also had the custom, which maybe you have something similar to this going on in your home, I know I do. They had the custom, which I would hesitate to call it that, of the fact that they had not cleaned out this geniza in 900 years. And as I said, I know that certainly there are rooms in my house that look like this, and I just haven't been living there long enough to have achieved this level of archival material. So when Salman Schechter opened this second-story hatch that was leading down to this room, this geniza in this Cairo synagogue, he opened that hatch and he saw a sea of paper. The paper was at first hidden by a cloud of dust, and when the cloud of dust sort of settled and parted, he saw that there was this pile of really of loose paper. It was about 20 feet deep, going back 900 years. So I don't know what you would do if you were in this situation, but Schechter, being someone who was an agent of the British Empire, did what all typical British imperial types might do, and paid off the locals and packed up all 193,000 documents and brought them back to Cambridge, because that's what you do when you're traveling around the world in the 1890s as someone from England. And when he brought these documents back to England, he found that some of these things were indeed priceless literary treasures, works of personal letters from famous people, first drafts of major philosophic or literary works, the kinds of things that you'll see if you go to an exhibit of manuscripts and things like that. But the vast majority of these 193,000 documents were things like grocery lists, sales receipts, love letters, personal documents, things like children's workbooks from school, medical prescriptions, timeless items like a note that read, "Please don't spank my child for being late. His homework delayed him." So this was not an archive. This was actually the medieval Facebook. This dumping ground for daily things, and it was crammed with so much mundane junk that you actually could reconstruct an entire world from it, except that over 100 years later, no one has even finished cataloging it yet. My new novel, A Guide for the Perplexed, is one that you can judge by its cover. It is a book within a book within a book, and I wish I were the one who could take credit for this artwork. Unfortunately, I'm not, but it's a very beautiful cover. It's a book within a book within a book. On the outside, it's about a woman who invents the next generation of social media. It's an app that records everything its users ever do, and then catalogs it according to their instincts, and uses it to predict their future. Now, when I finished writing this book 6 months ago, this was fiction. Now I think it's maybe Google Glass or Facebook Graph or something like this. Like, I mean, basically it now exists. But 6 months ago it was fictional, it was science fiction. And this is an app that really records everything its users do and sort of there's this ongoing record of one's life. Those of you who have read my other books know that I'm a little bit obsessed with injecting forgotten history into a plot worthy of an airport novel. And that's why this particular software developer ends up getting kidnapped in post-revolutionary Egypt. Because, that's what happens to software developers. They get kidnapped in post-revolutionary Egypt. That also makes this one of the first American novels about the Arab Spring. Mainly because I was simply so prescient that I started writing it before the Arab Spring, and then I was like annoyed when they overthrew their dictator because it meant that I had to change my plot. But it also meant that I had the opportunity to confront an astonishing historic moment when one of the world's oldest civilizations was suddenly forced to face a new world where everything was on the record. Part of my book takes place in the Library of Alexandria, which you might remember from fourth grade social studies as being the largest library in the ancient world, and which later, of course, burned to the ground. What you did not learn in fourth grade social studies is that the Library of Alexandria was actually rebuilt 10 years ago as a $200 million complex that has servers in it that actually have the world's only backup of the Internet Archive, the Internet Archive being the record of every web page ever created. Sort of like how the pharaohs had to be buried with all of their organs perfectly preserved. Sort of like this is something that people are good at in Egypt because no one believes that you can't take it with you. So this is the sort of the external plot of my novel, is this kidnapping story about the software executive. The story inside the kidnapping plot is a story about this software developer and her sister, and a very acrimonious relationship between them that affects both of their lives in ways that they could never have anticipated. And that story is very much inspired by the biblical story of Joseph and his brothers, retold in modern times and with women instead of men. I think it's deeply important that some of the world's oldest stories are about sibling rivalry. Not because it's true that mom always loved you best, although perhaps in Nicholson Baker's case that is true, because I know his mother is here. but not necessarily because of that reason, but because siblings are usually people who share a past, but who don't necessarily share a future. Sibling relationships are something that I'm very familiar with from my own life, not only from my children, but also because I have two sisters who are also published writers, and I have a brother who is an animator who just won his second Emmy. So creativity was something that was very obviously very important in my family, but I also think that our parents made us creative sort of inadvertently just by trying to manage us as children. One thing that we used to do as children is we used to torment our parents endlessly at the dinner table by constantly talking, never shutting up, and never letting anyone else finish a sentence. And perhaps some of you have experienced this in your own homes. And I don't know that I would recommend the solution that my mother found to this problem, which was that she came home from work one day with a kitchen timer, and she put this on the kitchen table, and she said, "From now on, each child gets 5 minutes to tell about his or her day, and anyone who interrupts that child will have time deducted." Well, the first result of this policy is that I now speak very quickly. So I apologize if your ears can't keep up with my mouth, because that's entirely my mother's fault. But the other result of this policy was that my siblings were not going to put up with this idea that they couldn't constantly offer their running commentary about what they thought about your day. So one of my sisters solved this problem by passing out index cards and pencils to everyone at the table. And people would then hold up signs while you were speaking with numbers on them, rating your day. Like, your day gets a 2.3, your day gets a -5, your day, sort of like at the Olympics. And, you know, I think when people are holding up a card while you're speaking saying your day stinks, it makes you very aware of what it means to tell a story and keep an audience engaged. So I think that during those dinners, my siblings really taught me something very important about what happens to days that disappear. If you're unlucky, they end up on a server or in a storage room in Cairo. But if you're lucky, they turn into stories. The Jews of medieval Cairo had an excuse for saving at all of these little pieces of their lives. They believed that their language was infused with holiness. Even the NSA has an excuse for recording all of our lives, whether or not we accept it. They at least pretend to come up with a reason. What is our excuse for constantly posting everything that we ever do online, for Instagramming every second of our lives? What is it about saving data that so many of us feel to be so compelling and also so necessary? I think it's a fear of mortality. The Egyptian pharaohs used to be buried in tombs where they're with images and texts and models of everything that they wanted to bring with them from one world to the next. I think that we similarly hope that if we could just save everything that happened to us, or at least everything positive that happened to us, then all of our momentary encounters like that also could be preserved. I think so much of what we want to preserve is fleeting. I don't know if you've ever noticed how often people online post pictures of food, like a dinner. You know, here's the dinner that I just made, or here's something I just saw in a restaurant. I always think, like, why are people putting pictures of food? And what I've decided is because that delicious dinner is about to become a pile of dirty dishes that someone has to clean up. It's this part of one of these fleeting moments. It's like the people post a picture of a glowing sunset, which soon is going to fade into darkness. a laughing man or woman who's soon going to leave them for somebody else, a smiling parent who will maybe pass away, crawling baby who's going to start walking. I think that we have this idea that if we can somehow freeze those moments or save those moments, that they will remain somehow forever unchanging, stored for eternity in some metaphysical space beyond time. And I think that may be why we call it the cloud. But I think that what's lost in that cloud is the art of forgetting. The selective memory that distinguishes trash from treasure. My parents spent 30 years as avid snapshot takers. Notice I said avid, I did not say good. And in their house, they have a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf of their photo albums from their documenting of our family's adventures as me and my siblings were growing up. It recently occurred to me that if my husband and I were to print all of the photos we've taken of our children, it would easily fill this room, which maybe wouldn't be a problem, except that our oldest child is only 8. Saving everything, I think it turns out, is eerily similar to saving nothing. And in sheer quantity of data, I think many of our personal lives might start to resemble that room in Cairo, a bottomless well of mostly trivial information with its treasures concealed in a cloud. This novel is called A Guide for the Perplexed, and it's named, as obviously Andy knows very well, it's named after a famous work of philosophy whose rough drafts were found in that storage room in Cairo. Its author, Moses Maimonides, was a 12th century Jewish philosopher and authority on Jewish law, but he also was a scientist. He published many scientific books, and he was a doctor. He was the chief physician to the Sultan of Egypt. And I think we often forget that everyone in every era thinks that they're living in modern times. And when you think about Maimonides in 12th century Cairo, it's important to remember that 12th century Cairo at that time was the tech capital of the world. This was at the crossroads of a global economy. This was at science's cutting edge. And in his book, he asks the question that so many of us are still asking now. Do we have the free will to control our future? Or are our lives determined by circumstances beyond our control? And for him, this was a religious question. But I think that that question still exists, even in a secular context, because today, in a secular context, predestination doesn't necessarily mean that everything in your life is predetermined by God. But we have still, in the secular world, that tendency to believe that everything is predestined, whether it's by genetics or by brain chemistry or by political forces or by laws of evolution. So that question of free will versus fate is still a very live one. Of course, as anyone with children knows, we can't control the future, and certainly we wish that we could. But I think that the power that we do have is our ability to control the past. And what I mean by that is not that we have the ability to change our past, but that we have the ability to curate our memories. In other words, the way we control the past is not by saving everything, but by selecting from that bottomless well of information what's worth saving. And it's that act of choosing what's worth remembering that can turn a lifetime's worth of memories into a story. I'm going to read just a couple pages from this novel, because it's funny, the first time I was asked to do a reading, and I got up to the podium and I looked out and I thought, it's so sad that all these adults never learned how to read. But I am going to read two or three pages from the beginning of my book, which describes really this software that my main character, Josie Ashkenazi, has created. And I probably don't even need to tell you that the name of the software she's created is Geniza. What happens to days that disappear? The light fades, the gates begin to close, and all that a day once held, a glance, a fight, a taste of bread, a handful of braided hair, thousands of worries and triumphs and regrets. All of it slips between those closing gates, vanishing into a dark and silent room. When Josephine Ashkenazi first invented Geniza, all she wanted to do was open those gates. At least that was how it started. In its earliest versions, the program Josie invented was little more than a variant on dozens of others. But then the software grew, unfolding before her like a prophetic dream. By the time she was 24 years old, Geniza was a vast platform that saved not only material its users deliberately created, but essentially everything else they did, cataloging worlds of data according to the user's habits. By the time she was 26, Geniza didn't merely store data, but tracked it, showing past trajectories and using them to predict the user's futures. By the time she was 27, she had married the company's chief engineer, had been the subject of a nationally televised documentary, and had had a baby. By the time she was 33, her six-year-old daughter Tali's every moment was recorded forever. But Tali knew nothing about it until one morning when, almost by accident, Josie showed her the archive of her life. "I can't find my shoes, Mommy," Tali had announced at breakfast. "I looked and looked, but they're nowhere." "That's impossible," Josie told her. "Where did you take them off yesterday?" "I don't remember," Tali said, losing interest. She was dressed, as always, entirely in orange, which she claimed was for safety. Now she was dipping the ends of her hair into her milk, painting the table white. Josie scaled the stairs and quickly glanced around Tali's bedroom, checked her closet, dropped to the floor to check under the bed, returned downstairs, looked in the kitchen, over by the TV. To Josie's chagrin, Tali seemed to be correct. The shoes were nowhere. "Now I can't go to school," Tali proclaimed. Josie sucked in her breath. She stepped to the kitchen counter and grabbed her tablet, entering passwords with a few quick taps. Under local panoramic search, she typed in Tali, then shoes. In an instant, an image appeared of Tali's new sneakers, mid-drop, as they descended from Tali's feet to the floor of Josie's car. "There they are," Josie said, and tipped the screen toward Tali. "You must have taken them off on the way home." Tali gaped and then ran to the garage. Josie followed her, opening the door and watching as her daughter's eyes bulged at the sight of the shoes on the car's floor. Tali shoved her sneakers on and climbed into the seat, still gaping. "How did you do that?" Tali asked. Josie took the tablet out of her bag and turned it toward her daughter. "I have everything from your life in here," she said. "That picture was pulled off the camera on my phone, from when the phone was in the holder between the seats facing you." Tali was baffled. "How did the camera know to take a picture?" "It happens automatically," Josie said. "The camera's running all the time. Then the pictures get saved in a program I made that collects everything and sorts it. Anything you ever want to remember, it's here." Tali stared at the screen, stunned. "Really? Like what?" "Like everything," Josie said. "Here's what happens when I search for your shoes, for instance." She tapped in keywords on the screen. "See, these are the first shoes you ever wore when you were about a year old." Josie looked at the picture and felt a sudden shiver as she saw her daughter at 11 months old, balancing on unsteady legs. Was that fat little baby the same person as a stringy six-year-old now staring at the screen? How was that possible? Josie shook away the thought and tapped out more words on the screen, silencing the breath of eternity over her shoulder. "And here's where we bought those shoes for you last week," she said. "When you got mad at me," Tali muttered. Josie frowned. She hadn't remembered that, though now it occurred to her that the shopping trip had been unpleasant, that she had been distracted by a message from her office, and Tali, in a bid for her attention, had knocked over a large cardboard display case, sending sneakers flying across the store. Josie slid into the driver's seat, unsettled. "Is everything from when you were little in there too?" Tali asked. "No, actually," Josie admitted. "I hadn't invented it yet then." "Lucky you," Tali said. Josie paused. "Lucky? Why?" "Because you get to remember everything the way you want, instead of how it really happened." Thank you for listening, since no one listens at home.
I'm thrilled to be here and back in the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you, Andy, for that introduction. And I love the idea that Dara was talking about of curating our memories. And I used to think about this a lot when I was working in Boston. I was a temp in my 20s trying to support myself. I was trying to write essays and short stories. And people would say such interesting things and have long conversations around me. And I didn't know that, you know, you could buy maybe a tape recorder and tape record them or something like that. And I would go home and I would think, this piece of life is just passing me by. So instead, I would try to write out the entire conversation that I'd heard. And it's and then you fall behind, and you're 3 days behind. You've got a little paper, kind of shirt pocket folded piece of paper with all sorts of notes on it that I furtively took, and I'm trying to remember what those notes meant. And somewhere, then suddenly, you're 6 days behind and 7 days behind, and you've forgotten it, and it's gone. It's so terrible, and yet it has to go. I mean, most of what we know, what we think, what we look at, what we really think about every day is gone. And so what that creates a problem for the novelist, because he's or she is trying to catch the texture of life, you know, without being boring. That's the hard part. How do you do it? How do you convey the specificity and the slowness of the way things, one thing shifts into another, without being so slow that people nod off? And I have tried to wrestle with that question for 15 books. And the book that this one, Traveling Sprinkler, is based on is a book by about Paul Chowder, my hero, who was trying to write an anthology of, who was trying to collect an anthology of rhyming poetry and trying to write an introduction to this art, that he was a non-rhyming poet, and he was looking over the fence at this beautiful green pasture of rhyming poetry and trying to talk about the complexities of meter and how it works. And the way I came to write it was by sitting in my yard on a white plastic chair and filming myself trying to explain iambic pentameter to some fictional audience. I thought, how would it work? How would you explain something like that? And I started saying lines of poetry to myself, you know, true wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed. And I realized that there was this secret life in an iambic pentameter line. It wasn't five beats, pent is five. There was a secret sixth beat there, and I thought, my God, I have a novel. And then I wrote the novel, and I saved that secret up to the very end, because you have to have suspense in a novel. And and then I thought I was done with Mr. Chowder. You know, he had yearned for his girlfriend had broken up with him. He yearned for him. Maybe there was a hint that they would get back together, and that was a happy ending enough. I like happy endings in books. And I wrote a book of essays. I collected a book of essays, and I wrote a very filthy book. And then I thought, no, I really would like to hear more from this guy. And I was in the middle of writing a nonfiction book about trying to write protest songs. And I thought, it shouldn't come from me. It should come from Paul Chowder. And as it happened, the floor of our barn, we live in South Berwick, Maine, and we have a big barn, and we have a lot of books in the barn, and the floor collapsed. And I thought, that's a bad thing. Obviously, it's bad for the barn floor to collapse. But on the other hand, something has happened to me. And down in the midst of this void of fallen book boxes and everything was this little green cast iron machine, a traveling sprinkler, which is it's the great American machine. It was patented in 1941 by a man who lived in North Platte, Nebraska, named Wilson. And he had this idea that you could have something that looked like a tractor that had the hose going in the end and the twirly things went around and it turned a gear in the middle and the gear turned two pawls that pulled the tractor-like wheels in the back slowly forward so that the tractor-like sprinkler moved. But it followed the route of its motive power. It followed its own history. The sprinkler moving forward was actually following the hose because the front wheel was like the sort of those atrophied claws of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's a little wheel that goes in the front and it follows the hose. And I thought that is the perfect metaphor for what the novelist is trying to do. He takes his hose, she takes her hose, wraps it around the garden of what there is out there that is confusingly there to be said, and then turns on the faucet and sees what happens. And sometimes the curve is too sharp, and the traveling sprinkler hops off the hose, goes AWOL, goes into not the direction that you want it to go, and that's okay. So that's the metaphor. I guess you could say it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. I love the idea that you can just say that. But the problem for Paul is that what happens if you got a couple of metaphors? So he starts thinking, I went outside and I sat in the green metal chair and tried to further my understanding of the problem of metaphorical interference. It's a serious problem, at least for me. What is metaphorical interference? Okay, well, it's when two or more strong metaphors are podcasting in the same room together and they mess with each other. They mix, but not necessarily in the very same sentence the way a classic mixed metaphor mixes. They mix structurally. Say, for example, that you've decided to mention the traveling sprinkler in your poem. The moment you mention it, it starts to twirl and hiss and spray water everywhere. It becomes a controlling metaphor. There's no help for it. You're going to get wet. But then, say, the traveling sprinkler seems to be tightly connected in your mind, perhaps by a long, pale green hose, to another idea that interests you, which is Debussy's piano prelude, The Sunken Cathedral. You think you're still all right because one is a real object and the other is a piece of classical music that contains a metaphor of submergence. But then you remember that some yellow jackets have made their nest in the hollow plastic handle of the hose reel. This happens to me every summer. I know that if my next door neighbor, Nan, says that I can set up the sprinkler's hose root around her tomatoes, I'm going to need my hose as well as her hose. And I know that as soon as I start wheeling the hose reel around and pulling the hose off it, the yellow jackets are going to fly out and dart at me angrily and sting me as I run away. I don't want to be stung, so I'll debate whether I should boil up a pasta pot of water and pour it on the hose reel handle, destroying the yellow jacket nest. My friend Tim told me about this technique, and I did it 2 summers ago. But I felt horrible afterward. What right did I have to destroy a whole happy nest of insects, regardless of how annoying they are when they crawl around on the potato chips? Now your poem is in trouble. You've got wasps in the hose reel, you've got the sprinkler twirling at the end of the hose, and you've got Debussy's cathedral sunk under the waves. You've got fish, you've got tomatoes. You're starting to get strange purple interference patterns, fringe moiré patterns at the edges of each metaphor where it overlaps its neighbors. Photographers call this purple fringing, and it's a flaw. This is the moment when your creative writing teacher may say, you've got an awful lot going on here, Paul. Maybe you need to pare this poem down and pick a controlling image. And you acknowledge that he has a point. Too many colors make the rinse water muddy. We know that. On the other hand, the world is full of metaphors that are happily coexisting in our brains, and we don't go crazy. You've got them all swarming and nesting and reeled up in there, but they don't trouble one another. One moment you entertain one metaphor, the next moment the next, no harm done. And this time you think, I don't want to worry so much about this rhetorical non-problem. I want to pour them all in and let them go wild together. Let all the metaphors fuck each other like desperate spouse swappers. I don't care. I summarily reject this notion of metaphorical interference for the time being, and I'm putting it aside, and I'm going to think over the things that call forth thought, and if they get in one another's way from time to time, that's just what happens. And that's what I tried to do in this book, is say, I want to put in this book every single thing that I have left in me that I feel is important and worth putting in a book, and I want to watch it all happen and boil, and I want to see it all mess with each other and see if there's a way to arrange the hose around all this stuff so that it doesn't create some kind of muddy mess, but something that a reader would actually be willing to tolerate. One of the things that helped me, actually, helped me write the book was that I'll tell you one thing that really helped me was smoking cigars. I went into a cigar store. I live in Maine, but Portsmouth, New Hampshire is the biggest city around, and they have this store that I had never been in before called Federal Cigar. I mean, isn't that a wonderfully blank name, Federal Cigar? I wandered in there, and I said to the guy, I want a really, really strong cigar that'll just smack me upside the head and help me finish this book. You know, I really want that. And he said, come in. And he opened the humidor room. It was this beautiful, still room. It looked like the place where all the incunabula is kept, you know. It's the secret library, the place. And instead of books, there were cigars. And I said, I want something, you know, really, really nasty. And he said, you want something robust. And he took me to the box that said Fausto. And I said, yes, absolutely. And I bought some Fausto cigars, and I smoked a lot of Fausto cigars in the car. I wrote this entire book in the car, sitting in the car. Every book I try to write in a different place, either one book in the lawn, one book in front of the fireplace, this book in the car with the window cracked slightly so that I wasn't hotboxing. So that helped a lot. And the other thing that helped me a lot was going to Quaker meeting. My wife and my daughter went to meeting. My mother came from a Quaker family. My grandfather was sort of an unhappy, uncertain Quaker. He talked about the ingrown toenail of the Quaker conscience. I went to Haverford College, which is a Quaker college, of course, and yet I didn't have any feeling about it. And then my wife and daughter went to this little meeting near us, an old meeting in a very old building, and they came back. And they said, this was an incredible experience. This woman stood and talked about two stones side by side in a creek, and everybody was crying, and it was fantastic. I thought, I've never been to any... I'm a non-theist. I don't like the word atheist. I'm not a theistic person, but I would like to sit in silence for a while and have somebody stand up and tell me about two stones side by side in a creek. That sounds good. So I went, and I found that the consensual silence was amazing. And you could almost feel, someone would say something that was imperfect, a fragmentary thing, and you could sort of feel it caroming around the room among other minds. It was just a great thing. And I would always feel that the old drag racing heats, you know, where the wheels would be spinning and the smoke would be rising from the wheels, but you couldn't move. You had to be silent. You had to be still. That was really powerful for me. And so I went to Quaker meeting, but I'd also smoked a big nasty cigar beforehand. And that's a problem because, you know, you're kind of trying to air yourself out before you go in. sat down on the bench at one point, and this very nice woman I knew slightly, I saw her look around and she then moved. So then you come out of meeting and you have a lot to say, you know. So here's what I said in the voice of Paul Chowder. Now meeting is over and I'm back in the car. One of the elders, Chase, the man who sang How Can I Keep From Singing, was shaking hands at the door when I went in. Meeting was crowded and there were a number of young children. I sat down in an empty stretch of pew, far enough away from the next person, a filmmaker I knew slightly, so that he wouldn't smell me. I put my finger through my key ring and closed my fist around my car key. People were smiling and looking around as they do while latecomers arrange themselves. The last to arrive were a mother and her three children, followed by an older man in a white shirt who sat next to me. He was a bit out of breath from hurrying, and I heard his breathing gradually slow down. I listened to the clock for a while and thought about how many people were wearing plaid. One woman had gotten her hair cut short in a way that looked very good. The clock is the most important thing. This clock just ticks. At first I thought, that is a parody of a clock. That cannot be a real clock. It is so loud. And then one day it actually ran out of springs. I mean, it just stopped. And the clerk of the meeting had to kind of gently and quietly and in a stately way go over and rewind the clock in the middle of meeting. And we still talk about that. I closed my eyes and felt that time was moving faster, maybe a little too fast. The windows were open and the door was open and the sound of a passing car traveled slowly through the room. After that, there was stillness. A little boy held his mother's gold watch, turning it in his hands and smiling a secret smile. Then the silence changed and deepened, and for several seconds it was perfect, and I felt a sort of ecstasy. Then someone shifted and adjusted a pillow for her back, and I could feel my pew bend when the man next to me crossed his legs. Again, a car sound poured softly in through the windows and out the open door. We were permeable. We were a meeting permeated with openness. After 15 minutes, Donna, the clerk, said, "We want to thank the children for worshiping with us. Can they shake hands around the room?" The children pushed themselves off their pew with serious faces and shook hands with the people who sat in the first rows of pews that faced the center of the room. There was a shockingly beautiful girl of about 6 with a barrette that was not doing a good job of holding her hair. She nodded politely as she shook the knobby hand of the oldest of the elders, a thin, tenderly smiling woman who wore hearing aid headphones. Then the children left, and I listened to them thumping down the stairs to the basement. Muffledly, I heard the teacher call, "Don't touch the stuff on the table yet." Then again, the clock and the silence. I looked down for a long time and bent over, leaning my elbows on my knees. Many minutes went by. I wondered who would speak. Nobody did. Surely some... This is a very big problem for me in Quaker meeting, is that it's silent. It's unprogrammed. You never know what's going to happen. And you really want... In order to understand the silence, you need someone to say something. Sometimes nobody says anything, and that's always the risk. And it's like that old game show where people shift in their seat at what was called What's My Line, I think. And there were 3 people, and at the end, one person would pretend to get up, and then no, it was another person. Well, it's very similar in Quaker meeting where someone is just shifting. He's just crossing his leg. You know, she's just getting her knitting to knit. She's not standing up to say anything. I didn't think that I should say anything because I'd said something about chickens the last time I went. On the other hand, someone should speak. I checked the clock. There were only 10 minutes of meeting left. A woman got up and I thought she was going to say something, but she just left to arrange the after-meeting food in the other room. Please, someone, say something. I wanted to tell the Quakers about Debussy's Sunken Cathedral. I kept formulating an opening in my head. A little more than 100 years ago, I wanted to say, a composer named Claude Debussy wrote a piece for piano called The Sunken Cathedral. He was a man with a big forehead who loved the sea. His most famous piece of music is called La Mer, the sea. In one of his early songs, he set to music a poem by Verlaine with the words, "The sea is more beautiful than cathedrals." But when he wrote his 10th piano prelude, The Sunken Cathedral, La Cathédrale Engloutie, he was no longer young and he was harassed by money worries and he had symptoms of the cancer that would kill him and he was thinking that life hadn't turned out quite the way he had expected. I wanted to tell them all this, but I couldn't because it was late and it was really too much to say in meeting. I always felt a little like a godless imposter among these genuinely worshipful folk. I wanted to say that in 1910, Debussy felt a great disappointment, that he wrote a friend that sometimes he wished he was a sponge at the bottom of the sea. Éponge, sponge, a usefully squeezable word in French. But then he came up with this piece of music, the 10th Prelude, and in it he created a great shadowy still place underwater, this place of peacefulness where when you listen to the music, you can go and watch the medieval fishes swim. I wanted to say that he'd always wanted to noyer le ton, to drown the tonality, and he did it by closing the lid of the piano and holding down the sustain pedal and letting the elements of the chord pile up. I wanted to say he was sick. He couldn't play the piano as virtuosically then as he had in music school, when he could noodle for hours and amaze his fellow students with harmonies that they'd never heard before. But out of his sense of disappointment, and out of his money worries, and out of his new sense of his own mortality, he built an ancient, crumbling, lost ruin that nobody had known about. And we can hear it and see it hanging there or standing there on the seafloor in the silence. I didn't say it. And that's the great thing about writing novels. You get to write down what you didn't say in Quaker meeting. Thank you very much.
Two very terrific and unique presentations. When I set this event up, I was trying to think of an excuse for how I could describe why I wanted to bring these two writers together. And I think they helped me out more backstage than I was able to figure out. But I had initially booked Nick, and we'd never had Dara, and I wanted to make sure that we finally got her here. And we were talking backstage about the significance of minutia, the Geniza, as this sort of ultimate repository, and then trying to relate it to some of the stuff you were doing with the sprinkler and finding all of the important things to say. That's all I have. So I'm looking to you for some help. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off?
It's like a Quaker meeting.
Yeah, is there somebody over here? Yeah, about 8 rows back.
Dara, recently I was at Central Synagogue in New York, and I heard and saw that you wrote commentary for the liturgy, which was very, very beautiful. So I'd like to ask you how that came about, and what was your inspiration besides the liturgy, which...
Sure. So the question is actually about, I was asked by, I've written 4 novels and all of them deal with themes from Jewish history and religion. And I don't know if it was the rabbi or the cantor, somebody at this Central Synagogue in New York City said that they were redoing the liturgy. And it's funny, while Nick was talking about the Quaker meeting, I'm thinking, like, this is exactly the opposite of a Jewish religious experience, where it's like, not only is there a program, there's a script, it's been the same script since the year 900. You know, we're reading it exactly the same, and even during the silent part, it's like, that silent part is like your opportunity to talk to your friend. You know, maybe not officially, but that's usually what happens. So it's funny for me to hear this. It's like, wow. Like maybe I might be able to benefit from a Quaker meeting too. So in this synagogue though, this is it's a Reform synagogue, and they were looking to the liturgy is very old and it's in Hebrew, and they were looking for something that would be sort of an English reading that they could use that would be sort of a poetic interpretation of this work. And I mean, I was just kind of astounded when they asked me to do this, because I've never written a poem in my life. I couldn't, all the metaphors, I couldn't, they would be wandering all over the place for me, and that would, like, it would bother me. I wouldn't be able to embrace the wandering metaphors or the traveling sprinklers. I tried to find a way to sort of render the Hebrew in English, but in a metaphoric way. I wrote what essentially they were like prose poems, but on the themes of the liturgy. So it would be like, there was one that was something about, the Hebrew was about creation. And so I don't even remember what I said, but there was a different sort of little vignettes about, walking past a tree and seeing a nest with a baby bird enfolded in an egg. And there were just, you know, there were other images that were from, you know, more personal experience, not my own experience, but sort of, and it was weird because it's like when you write a liturgy, it's like you have to like be writing for every person in the room who's coming to this from all different directions. But the truth is that I think it's not that different from writing a novel, because one thing, and I don't know if Nick has had a similar experience with this, where, you know, you write one book, but then when people read it, it turns out that everyone's reading a different book from the book that you wrote, which is actually, it's kind of a good thing because they're often reading a better book than the book that you wrote. And so that was my experience. Writing the liturgy was sort of like this very compacted version of like doing exactly what I would do with a novel in terms of trying to write something that, you know, that everybody's going to read their own experience into it in some very, very profound way. So I want to actually throw this question to Nick about the question of, you know, of set plans of liturgy, because of the scene that you read with the scene that you read about the Quaker meeting. It did make me think about the silence, and I wondered if there was a presence to the silence. I know for him there isn't, in a sense, and for him he's like so anxious about waiting to speak. But is there something that, like, are we supposed to be listening to the silence, or is that emptiness just sort of something that's always waiting to be filled? And I ask this question not just for your character, but for you as a writer, since so much of your work is really delving into this kind of, what people might say is, you know, sort of a non-event, an event that you wouldn't necessarily remember or think to delve into in the way that you do in your work.
Well, yes, I because I started as a classical musician, the part I like best, I guess now, this is a little fake to say, but that beautiful moment when you lower the tone arm and it touches the LP, and it's not exactly silent because you hear all the stuff that's going on in those grooves, but you're waiting for something to happen. It's an expectant silence, and that's what the Quakers call it. It's expectant waiting. You're waiting for something to happen, and I've always liked this feeling that I used to use earplugs. I used to jam earplugs in my head and wait for something to happen. Sometimes it did, or I sit in the car. I'm waiting. It's a very silent place. The windows, you know, it's the quietest place you can find often. So out of silence, you wait for words to kind of gather themselves and form themselves. So that's what it's a rich kind of silence if you're willing to wait or if you approach it in the right frame of mind. Other times you just sit and you're silent and you're waiting for something to happen, and nothing happens, and it's very sad, and it's just that day was a dud. But even then, you have to write. I always follow the thing that it's good to write every day, regardless of whatever, whether you're inspired or not, because it's just soothing to write. And so even though you're moving, it's soothing to type. That's what I find. I love typing. I was a professional typist, so I can actually type. And it's something I'm proud of, like being able to park a car, you know. It's a little trick that I have learned from life, and I move my fingers and I type, and it's pleasurable. And sometimes the words are not particularly interesting, but they form a paragraph that then make me think of something 3 days later. So that, in that sense, it's expectant waiting as well.
Have you continued on with the cigars for inspiration?
There's a limited use of cigars before stressful occasions. Find a third of a very, very long cigar is helpful, but no, I don't think it's a good idea. My grandfather died of throat cancer. It's not a good thing to smoke cigars at all, but it's Nicaraguan tobacco. Think what that means. It's I had no idea. You know, people smoke. I didn't understand why people bothered to smoke. My son actually went to Spain and came back with a cigar in a plastic bag. And I had to write this profile of David Remnick for a men's fashion magazine in England. And it was very high stakes because Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker, and I'd interviewed him, I had lunch with him. I didn't want to embarrass myself. And I thought, I've got something in a plastic bag. And I smoked it, and I wrote the thing. It just happened. And I realized that this is what people are talking about. Tobacco is a very powerful mental stimulant. But very, very bad for you.
Does it work for you, Dara, the cigar trick?
No, I actually find I don't have the luxury of having writer's block because I only can write from certain hours of the day, and then my house turns into something very different from a work environment. You talked about your car being the quietest place. I'm like, that's not my car. A very different kind of car. Not having anyone yelling at me or pulling on my clothing is very inspirational for me.
Why don't we move on? Another question? Yeah, right here in the second, third row.
Dara, you mentioned this collection of material that was in the Cairo Geniza, and of course Schechter was very much interested in all of these major documents that he found. But we had a professor here in Philadelphia, Professor Guettein, who took all the laundry lists and grocery lists and put it together in one of the six volumes he wrote about a Mediterranean society. So there's really something that one could find in there. The other thing I was thinking about was having read Nick's book on, about what libraries have been doing to all of those archives of newspapers that we thought they were saving for us, and have been basically shredding this stuff, and this terrifying type of loss of materials. I was wondering, first of all, I'm thinking of that as sort of our modern day Geniza, but that is sort of being trampled upon or being destroyed. But I was wondering to what extent your project has been successful in trying to rescue some of that material. That I know you sent some of it to Duke.
Yes.
So what's happening with your project? Have you been able to rescue a significant amount of that material?
So the question is about my little attempt to save all the fleeting lost bits of the past. What happened was I was writing about libraries. I'd written about a library in San Francisco that had sent a lot of books to a landfill, and then this man told me about this clean out of American libraries of bound volumes of newspapers. I started to write about that and learned that one of the last surviving runs of Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, in fact, I think the last surviving run of the greatest publication probably in American history, was being auctioned off by the British Library. And I thought, this is terrible. This is a terrible thing to happen because it's so rare and so important. Think of a basement in New York City where this Austrian immigrant, brilliant, genius man, created something, and a million copies flowed out of a basement all over New York City. It was all of cable. It was all of radio. It was everything in 1910. The New York World was it. And out of all of that, no copies except on microfilm survive. So, and microfilm is not a good way of capturing four-color beautiful things or even type. So I became exercised about that and wrote a book called Double Fold about that whole thing. But in the midst of it, I sort of stopped writing the book and founded a nonprofit and raised $150,000 to buy this newspaper collection for the British Library, which ended up at Duke. That was the eye-opening, the greatest experience of my life, in fact, I think. My wife and I were the greatest adventure that we had together, but also just the looking at a room in which there are, say, 50 tons of stuff, of printed stuff, and realizing you will never, ever be able to read even one millionth of it. Knowing that it's unknowable and that you have responsibility for it is a very terrifying thing. And librarians do this every day, and a lot of the time they do it brilliantly. And of course, librarians had created these bound volumes that then were being guillotined and microfilmed and tossed out. So I ended up having a sort of a granular feeling about the past that I hadn't had before, and that led me to write a book called Human Smoke about the lead-up to World War II. It changed the way I thought about everything was looking at that much unreadable printed material.
I want to say something about this also, that sort of feeling of, like you said, that the unknowable quality of it. You mentioned Goitein, who was the person who finally, you know, Schechter went and found the famous stuff in the Geniza and then kind of left it for, you know, he ended up having another career, basically, in New York. And then Goitein came 50 years later and discovered, you know, and really sort of found all those the things that actually were in crates marked rubbish. At the library in Cambridge, we literally said rubbish on the side of the crate. And he really did sort of reconstruct that world in the five. And that I used part of the book. Part of the book is about Schechter. And it's, you know, Schechter's a character in the book, and it's about his discovery of the Geniza. But part of it also takes place in the 12th century from the point of view of Maimonides. And to write that chapter, I used Goitein's research and a lot of the material from the Geniza just to create, like, well, how would you have gone to work every day? And, you know, what were they eating? You know, and those kinds of questions. What you said about, you know, this feeling of, visceral feeling of seeing all this material, you know, this sort of printed material that can't be replicated on microfilm, it made me think of my academic work, as I mentioned, is in Hebrew and Yiddish literature. And for Yiddish literature, something like this exists in Amherst, Massachusetts. There's something called the National Yiddish Book Center because the man who founded it discovered that you know, a lot of books that were a lot of Yiddish books were being thrown away because the person who knew Yiddish died, and then the person's children didn't read Yiddish, and they're like, well, why do I need these books? And so he sort of made this nationwide and now international project to collect Yiddish books. And I've been a beneficiary of that project because I did my doctoral work in Yiddish literature, and I mean, these are books I couldn't find any other way. I mean, I was buying books from, you know, that always had like somebody's name in them, and it was like a dedication, you know, to my son, blah blah. And you're like, the son probably never read this, but now I'm reading it. But you know, one thing that is sort of it's upsetting though, because when you go to the Yiddish Book Center and they've sort of painted it as like this, we're rescuing Yiddish literature. The truth is, a lot of those books are translations of books from other languages into Yiddish. So it's like, you know, they have like whole shelves of the Yiddish edition of What Every Girl Should Know. You know, it's like, and you're just thinking, like, you know, like, who is, like, this is truly, like, who is going to read this? And that, you know, and I mean, in the same way, like, you know, in a sense, who is going to read, you know, these thousands of copies of the New York World? And, or even, but even more so, because it's like, you know, you can read the original of What Every Girl Should Know if you really are interested in this. And it's sort of, It's a very oppressive feeling. It's, I think, very similar to what Nick said at the beginning of his remarks about, you know, I started writing down what was happening every day and then you fall behind. And it's sort of, you have this sinking feeling. And I think it is something that writers feel all the time because we are so consciously trying to capture moments, even if we're not writing autobiographically. But it is something I think that all of us feel. And I do think it has to do with a confrontation with mortality.
One more question, right here in the front row. There's a mic coming to you from your right.
How did you come up with the idea of the world of the not yets in the other book, The World to Come?
Oh, this is a question about...
Where did that come from? That's
sure.
Amazing.
This is a question about one of my earlier books, and it's about a chapter that is at the end of one of my books called The World to Come, which takes place in a sort of a supernatural world where it's this supernatural world is populated by children who haven't yet been born and people who have already passed away in their families who are sort of teaching them everything that they need to know before they're born. It came from, there's a legend in the Talmud and in a couple of other Jewish sources that, and it's funny because it appears in other sources and other cultures too. I think it's in Plato also in another form. But it's a story in the Talmud that talks about how before a child is born, that child is taught all of the secrets of the Torah. And then just before the child is born, an angel smacks him across the face, and that's why we have a dent below, you know, over our lip, below our nose, and says, you know, you better shut up and not tell these secrets. And then the child forgets everything that he's learned, and he's born, you know, and has to spend the rest of his life trying to remember those things. And so I was sort of imagining how that would be taught. And then there's also an idea in traditional Judaism about how the merits of one's ancestors can intercede on one's behalf. And that's always sort of been a very abstract idea. And so I guess I was sort of taking those two ideas and making them in very concrete form in the book. And you know, it's a funny thing when you try to write something like that when, you know, I put it at the end of the book, so people are already sort of invested by the time they get to the end. I mean, I had another book where I had a chapter in biblical verse at the end of the book, and that's like, it's something you can get away with at the end of a book, you know, because like people have already read like 250 pages. Like, they're not going to stop now, right? You know, they're going to at least like follow you and see where you go with it. Whether they like it, it's different, but you know, it's like they're stuck with you at that point. So you can kind of get away with a lot of things at the end of a book. I've thought about this a lot in terms of my books often sort of are have this sort of interplay between our world and a world beyond our world, which isn't in that book. It's very explicit, but in all of my books, it is it's there, and it's not necessarily a religious vision. It's more of a vision of it's more of an awareness of the limitations of human knowledge and the limitations of human creativity, which I think is something that is not. It's not really part of Western culture, this awareness of human limitations, as much as it is part of traditional religious cultures. But that's what I find very sort of compelling as a creative writer and as an artist, in a sense, is that, you know, there's sort of at the bottom, there's something kind of idolatrous about being an artist. And I say that, you know, both from a religious and a secular point of view, because you know, you're doing something where you're supposedly creating something out of nothing, and there's something that to me feels wrong about that. And in all my books, I'm exploring the idea of creativity. And so in this novel, it's about a software developer. I have another novel where it's about an artist. I have another novel where it's about an actor. You know, there's sort of different ways where I explore sort of what it means to be a creative person, and not just you know, the agony of an artist and, you know, recognition and fame and those kinds of questions. Those are less interesting to me. But what's interesting to me is sort of the hubris that's required to create a world. And that's something that it's just a subject that animates a lot of my work. And I would throw this back to Nick also to say that he's like, I hope he was listening. No, he is. I would throw this back to you to say, because you also are writing about people who are creating and struggling to create, and you know, while you know, you're you know, obviously not coming in from a religious perspective, at least based on the character at the Quaker meeting. But I'm sort of, you know, I think that there is a kind of a hubris kind of in, you know, let's say trying to think that you can affect the world by writing a protest song or something like that.
Yeah, there's a sort of a presumption. The terrifying presumption is that other people will want to know what you have to say. That's a scary thing. And it's not always true. And I think one of the useful things for every writer to recognize is that his or her books are not for everybody. That this particular book that you have slaved over and knocked yourself out and poured everything that you have into is not going to be for... But and also that it is. It's kind of... It's a leap. It's a frightening decision. I mean, I don't know what possessed me to think that I should write a book, that my first book should be a definitive book about breaking one shoelace on one day and then the next shoelace the next day, and that was an amazing coincidence, and therefore my hero should go out on an errand and buy new shoelaces. But that was going to be my first book. That was my entrance into the world. Why would I think that was the right way to begin? And yet it felt desperately important at the time. You know? I felt actually, in a contrarian sort of way, that enough with the big plots and the insider trading and whatever it is. Let's concentrate on what actually you think about during your lunch hour. That's the kind of thing. You run an errand. You know, and that I would then, it gave me the energy to make that kind of presumptuous decision to home in on something small.
Now you know why we're here. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dara Horn and Nicholas and David.
Thank you. That was lovely.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.